Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I want to introduce you, Yi. This is my guest co-host, Dr. Yi Lam, who is one of our graduating resident physicians and soon to be starting her fellowship at UNC Family Medicine, and she's filling in for Adam today. Welcome, Yi.
It's great to be here.
On our show today, Yi and I will be talking with Dr. Marco Iacoboni, professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences at UCLA, about anger prevention and treatment. And we're excited to have this conversation today. It's a timely topic with so much violence and anger and risks of that, and some of those conversations around the world. This is a real expert in how the brain works that we'll get to talk to today.
Exactly, and specifically in how media portrays people who do commit some of these terrible things that we see. Does that really encourage other people to do similar things?
I know. Interesting questions. I look forward to that conversation. But first, Yi, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about, we talked earlier, Adam and I, about risks of rapes on campuses and colleges, and we're going to talk a little bit about a strategy to reduce that.
We're also going to be talking about a common heartburn medication and what that means for heart disease risk.
Mm-hmm. About gun violence and its risk for kids' mental health.
And then we'll be tackling a question that a lot of people have asked is, should you eat your placenta?
Interesting questions. Okay, we're going to start with what is a very sad bit of information that Adam and I covered several weeks or months ago, Yi. We were talking about this high risk of young women when they start college, especially in those early years of college, for having a sexual assault or being a victim of sexual assault. And we wondered if there are ways to prevent that. Are there ways to train? Are there programs that can really prevent those problems and protect these young women?
So there's actually a training program that they tried in Canada at a university there, and basically provided these sessions to help young women resist sexual assault. And this ended up decreasing the rate of completed rapes in the first 1 to 2 years of college for these women.
Yeah, this was a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It was a randomized control trial at three different Canadian universities where they took first-year female students aged 17 to 24, email, contact them, and of the people who wanted to be a part of it, they randomly selected a control group who just got a regular session and were given some brochures. And the other half got special training programs with multiple sessions and teaching them how to assess risks from acquaintances, how to acknowledge and sort of pick up on dangers, and how to engage in effective verbal and physical self-defense. And as you say, Yi, it was pretty effective in reducing. The control group had 5.2% self-reporting of victimization versus 9.8% in the control group. So it looked like there was a much reduced risk, even for attempted rape, for the group who had some of this intervention and training.
So a very important study, absolutely, in helping to prevent a very sad outcome that sometimes can happen early. So on to the next research that matters is, recently we were talking about some medication that a lot of people take, like Prilosec, and how that actually has shown to perhaps have an increased risk of causing heart problems.
Yeah, this has been all over the news. Everybody's talking about it, but we figured we needed to at least share our perspective on the show from the physician perspective. So these are drugs called proton pump inhibitors, or PPIs, like omeprazole, Prilosec, over-the-counter. There's Nexium. There are all kinds of different related ones, but a lot of people take them. More than 20 million people in the U.S. use one of these PPI drugs each year.
And they found that people who take these medications who have reflux had a 16% more increased chance of having a heart attack than those who didn't, and they were twice as likely to die of a heart issue. Now, they don't know that this is enough information to say you shouldn't be taking this kind of medication, especially if it is treating a severe reflux, but it's something at least to think about. They also said that another medication often used to treat heartburn called H2 blockers, Zantac, ranitidine is in that class, did not show similar results.
So the thought was that maybe some effect that these PPIs have on reducing nitric oxide in the blood vessels that might have some link or some link with this increased risk for heart attacks. But there was also a suggestion that maybe this is just a sicker population. If you're already on one of these medicines, maybe you have other medical problems that they weren't able to totally control for in the study. So more study is needed. I think if you're already taking one of these medicines, you should talk to your doctor about those potential risks. And if by changing your lifestyle, changing what you eat, when you eat, and going over some of those parts of your life that can reduce your symptoms, and if taking medicines like ranitidine or Zantac that you can get over the counter, if by doing those things control your symptoms, then I would say talk to your doctor about it, but it would make a lot of sense to try those things and see if you can come off that PPI.
You might get some extra benefits like weight loss and other healthy habits.
Good point, Yi.
On to our next point of research that matters is something that I think we've all felt is probably true just kind of hearing about it, that gun violence does take a toll on children's mental health. A recent study showed that 1 in 4 children in the U.S. are exposed to weapon-related violence.
I mean, I know 1 in 4 children. I couldn't believe that as a victim or a witness of weapon related violence, 1 in 4. And that increases their risk of having mental health problems, like depression, anxiety, aggression, anger problems, and, you know, related to that kind of trauma that happens to them as children.
And really the understanding as well that just being a witness is actually being someone who's very deeply affected because their safety is also at very high risk if they're witnessing an event like this. And that can definitely lead to some of these mental health outcomes down the line.
I know. So we need to do something about this in our nation, but we also need as providers and as families to really make sure that children are getting what they need in terms of safety and also follow up for mental health if they've had those exposures as children. Let's talk last about should you eat your placenta?
And this is something that actually came up very recently for me while working with some of our patients in prenatal care and who are happy to be welcoming babies into the world. I did actually get a question from one of my new moms about encapsulating her placenta, which basically means making it into a form that you can eat. What do you think about this, Christy?
Well, a lot of my patients have done this. So it is something that people do, I think, probably especially in our area. And I think there are certain species of animals who eat their placenta, and women think they're trying to do everything possible to be moms and to do everything possible to be healthy and to improve their own health and the health of their children. And there's a lot of sort of, there are some famous celebrity moms who swear by it, and there's a lot of sort of, it's kind of a trendy thing to do in some ways. And the thought is that maybe it could help reduce postpartum depression or pain, improve energy, help with breastfeeding, help with bonding, or some people say it helps improve your skin elasticity, maybe decrease those stretch marks. I don't know.
Sounds like all-around good things.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. But so this practice of eating one's placenta is called placentophagy, which just means eating the placenta. Some people will arrange with someone to take the placenta and they can dry it and encapsulate it into these little pills, and then they take it during that first little period of time. So this was a study kind of looking, one of those systematic reviews, looking at the 10 published studies that are out there to see what we know.
And exactly like things that Christy mentioned already, some benefits that people had, you know, over time heard were possible with eating the placenta, the study actually didn't show that any of those things happened necessarily. They also showed that there were no really great regulation for how this process of making it edible is done. And so there may perhaps be some risk.
Yeah. So out of the 10 published studies, there was no data to support any health benefits of any of those things I mentioned, whether they ate it raw, cooked, or in pill form. And there were also no studies that examined the risks associated with eating the placenta. And there are no regulations, as you're saying, so you don't really know if someone else is packaging and formulating it for you, what exactly you're taking in. I don't know what you said to what did you say to her?
Well, you know, it was really more of a question of what kinds of lab tests that she needed to have done in order to have this process go forward. And so I just provided that information, but I've never actually talked to anyone about this. So the study is interesting and will be helpful to get a gauge too for what the woman is hoping to perhaps gain from eating the placenta is an important part of the conversation as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't prevent someone from doing it. It's not something I would routinely recommend that people do because there's no, as we're saying, no data to say it has benefit and there may be risk. But for someone for whom someone this is really important to them, mm-hmm. then I'm going to be supportive of it because if it's important to you as a mom and that's part of what is you're doing to make good steps for your child, as long as you're aware that there may be risks and that we don't have any proven benefit to it, then people should be able to make their own choices about that.
And that's why it's great to have a good relationship with your provider to have these kinds of conversations.
Very good point. All right. That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Marco Iacoboni, professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences, about anger, prevention, and treatment. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Yi Lam. And we will also be welcoming a second guest producer, Dr. Catherine Koh, for that conversation with Dr. Iacoboni. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. I'm Dr. Christy Page, and I will introduce my guest co-host for this segment, Dr. Catherine Koh. Welcome, Catherine.
Thanks so much. It's great to be back.
Oh, it's great to have you back with us on the show. And today on Conversations, Catherine and I will be talking with Dr. Marco Iacoboni, professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences at UCLA, about anger, prevention, and treatment.
Welcome, Dr. Iacoboni. We're so happy to have you on the show today. You are a neuroscientist at UCLA, but in the Department of Psychiatry and Biobehavioral Science. Wondering what sparked your interest in psychiatry, and if you could explain what biobehavioral science is.
I wish I knew. Well, that was a joke. I'm a neuroscientist by training. I'm also actually a neurologist, but at some point when I moved from Italy, you can guess I'm Italian from my accent.
Uh-huh, it's lovely.
Thank you. I would have counted on that. What I decided to do is, I really wanted to pursue my research in neuroscience, and because my medical license is Italian, I had to go over the whole licensing process again, and it didn't make much sense.
Mm-hmm.
But being a clinician myself, being trained as a neurologist, the neuroscience I do is always in some way related to health and to thinking about human beings as entities that are very important for the kind of research I do. So in our department in psychiatry, there's plenty of people that are just, they're not clinicians, they're PhD in neuroscience. And the research we tend to do is important for mental health, of course. That's why I'm in that department.
Well, great. And you've pioneered research. I mean, you've been very successful in your work here in the States, and you pioneered research in something called mirror neurons. Tell us a bit about these neurons and how they play a role in behavior.
Yeah, this was a discovery made about 20 years ago in the monkey brain, and this was something so unexpected that even the scientists that made the discovery, initially they wouldn't even believe it. And only after many, many controlled experiments, they came to terms with realizing that this was a real phenomenon. The phenomenon is the following. They were studying these cells in the brain of the monkey that controls grasping. And grasping is an essential, a crucial action in our life to try to get out of the house without grasping the doorknob. It's impossible.
Grasping, so like grabbing the doorknob, being able to use your hand in that way.
Right, exactly. So they were saying these cells, but they found that not only, you know, when the monkey is grasping something, the cells fire, but some of these cells also fire when the monkey is simply observing someone else making the grasping action.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in an area of the brain that they knew it's important for control the behavior of the monkey, the movement of the monkey. So this was completely unexpected. And the idea was that to figure out what it meant, well, of course, the scientists started to think about what's the role of this. And one of the initial ideas was that, well, these neurons may be important for recognizing the actions of other people. But then from this, one goes to something deeper. That is, maybe this system in the brain is important for empathizing with others. So if I use my same neurons in my own brain that I use when I grasp a cup of coffee, whenever I see you, Christy, grasping a cup of coffee, I don't have to really make a lot of inference to figure out what's going on in your mind. I understand it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this mechanism in the brain creates a connection between me and you.
So, Dr. Iacoboni, is that also why when Christy yawns, I also feel the urge to yawn as well?
Oh, yeah. It's a well-known phenomenon. Yawning is extremely contagious. There are many other things that are contagious. Emotions are contagious. Behaviors.
Just to clarify, you can't see me, but I'm not yawning at you right now. But I do.
Okay.
It is fascinating because I see. I mean, for example, when on my husband's side of the family, when anyone feeds an infant, like you take the spoon and you get the baby food and you're trying to get the baby to open the mouth and like use their tongue, on his side of the family, any of them, when they feed a baby, they can't help themselves, but they open their mouth and do their tongue, twist their tongue a certain way as they're trying to get the baby to do. And I've always wondered, like, I don't do that, but that happens in his family, but it must have something to do with, it must have been somehow related to these mirror neurons.
Absolutely. And what happens is that the more emotional is the situation, and when you're, you know, when you're looking at the baby and gets fed, it becomes an emotional situation, the more people tend to do that. There is individual differences. Some people do it more than others. And there are two reasons why there are these individual differences. Some are because people tend to be more or less empathic. And the other aspect of it is that some people tend to be more controlled than other people. And so you may feel a little silly to open up your mouth when the baby is opening the mouth. And so you don't do it because you're more controlled. That doesn't mean you're less empathic. But some people tend to be less empathic or less attuned to other people, too.
Interesting. And I hope that we'll get into how this also ties into behavior. So there's empathy and control that may or may not influence how much you do this for a particular activity. But also, as we see, you know, violent acts either in movies or on TV or in the media, how that influences what we might choose to do after we've seen it.
Yes, there's plenty of data in the social sciences that show that if you're exposed to violence early on in life, you are going to show more violent behavior later on in life.
But is that about the motor neurons, or is that more other learned behavior?
Well, I mean
the mirror neurons, sorry.
Most of this research has been done behaviorally well before mirror neurons get discovered, but now that we know that we have mirror neurons in the brain, it makes a lot of sense to think that mirror neurons are sort of the culprits of this kind of tendency to imitate violent behavior in other people. So I call it the dark side of mirror neurons because, I mean, they would believe that they're mostly important for empathizing, but basically they facilitate any kind of contagion, any kind of behavior that mimics the behavior of other people.
Have people been able to quantify how many mirror neurons someone has and whether or not more mirror neurons make someone more likely to act out when they're exposed to violence or aggressive behavior?
I know those are the kind of things that still our neuroscience tools are not able to really grasp completely. And again, the story is probably more complex than that because it's not just about how many mirror neurons you have, but also how much those mirror neurons are kept in check by your control system, by your cognitive control. And that's also important. So we're actually working on that, but it's a fairly complex story. But I would say that it's very likely that what happens when you have evidence for imitative violence is that mirror neurons are involved.
This has so many implications on how we raise children, on what we expose people to, on and you wonder if people use it as like a defense of, well, I couldn't help it because of these mirror neurons. So I want so much to get into some of those issues and talk about some of those things in the second segment. This is fascinating. We do need to take a short break, which we'll go ahead and do. But when we come back, we will we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Marco Iacoboni, professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences at UCLA, about anger, about prevention, and about treatment as this relates to these mirror neurons. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Catherine Koh. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Catherine Koh, our guest host today. We've been talking with Dr. Marco Iacoboni, professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences at UCLA, about anger, prevention, and treatment. Before the break, Dr. Iacoboni was explaining to us some of the research around mirror neurons, these cells in the brain that cause us, when we see someone do something, like yawn or feed a baby, that sparks a mirror, some process in our brains that then make us, depending on how empathetic and how our ability to have control, do those same actions or experience those same ways or have that part of the brain fire at the same time we're watching someone else do something. And it just sparks so many questions that Catherine and I have for you, Dr. Iacoboni. And one is this sort of nature versus nurture. So, I mean, this is really combining the two, that there's something in the brain based on the experiences that we have that get formed or shaped or lit up in a way when we experience things. So children who experience violence or if they experience love or whatever happens as we raise our children then has an impact on perhaps brain formation. And that's a piece of why children who are raised in violence are more likely to go on to more violence. How do you articulate or explain to people the intricacies of how these cells in the brain work as a piece of the puzzle of nature versus nurture?
That's a great question. Not even sure I can articulate much better than you did. We know that there is this interplay between nurture and nature. If we look at mirror neurons, we know that there probably are some mirror neurons at birth, although, you know, we don't really poke into the brains of infants. Mm-hmm. But infants, very young infants, the youngest one that was documented was 41 minutes old, they can imitate some rudimentary facial gestures. Wow. And so the idea is that most likely there are mirror neurons in the brain of the newborn already. But we also know that experience really changes our brain. And clearly, we believe that the more nurturing and empathetic is the environment in which the baby is raised, the more mirror neurons get created. But on the other hand, as you say, there is also the other side of the story, which is if you are raised in an environment that is full of violence, you pick up the violence and you become violent in yourself. The other issue is that, unfortunately, in our society, we inject often violence for really no reason. One thing is to be raised in an environment that is violent. One thing is to play video games that are violent and they try to be violent. There is really no reason to have those video games. I know it's a complicated issue because it impinges on free speech, but there should be something that we should do in terms of trying to educate even, the gaming industry. Games are actually a great potential tool for education, and I think we're losing an opportunity as society to educate our kids to do better.
So, Dr. Iacobani, for those parents who may be listening today, what advice do you have for them in terms of setting a healthy example and for us as a community how to prevent these mirror neurons from firing and creating more anger and violence in our community?
Right. That's another great question. Well, to parents, I know it's not easy. It's a tough thing to do, but be in control. Control your emotions. If you're stuck in traffic and you're frustrated and someone cuts you, don't yell. Don't show anger, because your baby is a imitation machine, is looking at you and will pick up that kind of anger, and will pick up also the fact you cannot control your emotions. Being able to control emotions are a great thing. They really give meaning to life, but they need to be in control. So it's not an easy thing to do, because again, there is plenty of frustrating situations in everyday life that lead us to do things that are, you know, in which we are not so much in control and we display negative emotions. But the idea is that to try to show as much as possible positive emotions and to control negative emotions as much as possible.
And then, as you were alluding before, really thinking carefully about what we allow our children to be exposed to in the gaming world. It's hard to know. I mean, as a parent of a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old, thinking of, I mean, all the games, even the ones that are just like little Nintendo Donkey Kong kind of games, have killing in it. You know, people die. They usually come right back to life. This is also not realistic. But, you know, there are some that are just so graphic, and my kids have never seen those, to my knowledge, and I'll keep those out of the house. But, you know, there's like the extreme, and then there's all the gray in between, and we're all trying to figure out what is okay. They see it, you know, they see things on TV and on movies, and trying to figure out that line as parents is really challenging. What I'm hearing from you is it does matter.
Oh, it does matter. I mean, there's plenty of, again, social science data that suggests that it does matter. And the people should try to be mindful about these things. Even violence in, you know, the movies. Again, it is the kind of thing that it's very difficult to control, because, again, it kind of infringes on free speech. But we should have at least an open debate in our society on how to try to foster things that facilitate pro-social behavior rather than aggressive behavior.
Well, we did say in the name of the show that we talked a little bit about prevention in raising our children around love and control of anger and positive environments. But what about treatment? For there are a lot of people in this world, as you know, who were raised in violence and who had that formed. And what can people do to help either reprogram their brain or move forward?
That's a great question. We're doing actually some research that is relevant to it. The idea would be to really try to restore empathy. And one of the beautiful things about mirror neurons is that they give us a sense that we can have a handle about this really complex thing, which is empathy, through very simple things. I mean, in fact, there are data that show that very simple interventions based on imitation games can actually improve the empathy of people. So
like
this
you can
is one
reprogram.
Of that it's really important to try to do. And we are doing some research on this to really try to understand the mechanisms that allow to restore empathy in the brain of someone that has reduced empathy.
Could you give us an example of some of the studies that you're doing and how exactly what games you're playing with these people in order to try and reprogram their brains?
Yeah, we do a fairly complex series of things. We put them in the scanner first, and we measure how much their brain mirrors other people. Then we get this information, and we actually put them in a situation. So this is a fairly, we call it pre-reflective, because it's just emotion. You see someone in pain, someone displaying emotions. Then we let them play an economic game in which they share a certain amount of money with other people. And we look at how much these things correlate. And eventually what we do is that we do a couple of interventions. One is we put a technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation that allows us to modulate activity in the brain. And the other one with a simple series of imitation games in which they look at someone that looks at an object and they do the same, or they imitate actions of other people, or they imitate emotions of others. And by doing that, we look at how much we can influence the behavior and the mirroring of people.
Well, we know through certain forms of counseling and cognitive behavioral therapy that there is hope for people who have had difficult traumas in their life. And so you wonder how these new things that you're testing will interface and work together with that bigger, broader approach that usually requires multiple different angles of helping people move forward in their lives.
Right. I think that what we need to do is to really build a common language between people that do interventions and people like myself that are in the lab and try to figure out how the brain works when it comes to these kinds of situations. And it's happening. It's going to take time, but I'm often invited to meetings of psychotherapists. And I think that the more we actually do this kind of we connect with these professionals, the more we are able to move from the lab to real-life interventions.
Well, I have to say, in one of your bios online, it says something about how you don't give a damn about the brain, that you care about the human soul. And it's clear that you're doing work that is deep and meaningful, and that has great potential to really help both in treatment of people who've had violence and trauma in their lives, but also in helping us move forward with positive experiences for people that shape the brain for a more positive future. So thank you for the research that you're doing and for taking time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Dr. Marco Iacobani, professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences at UCLA, about anger prevention and treatment in mirror neurons. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Catherine Koh. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Yi and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please do send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we have a couple of great topics to discuss today.
We're going to talk about diabetes and medicines.
And we're going to talk about blood pressure and different supplements that can affect blood pressure.
About alcoholism and medications for that.
And we're going to talk about rectal bleeding.
All right. We've got some good questions today. We'll have our executive producer, Erica Nori, read us our very first House Call question.
I've had diabetes for over 30 years. It was never well controlled, but never awful either. Over the last 2 months, it's gotten really well controlled, and my doctor is beginning to cut down my medications. I haven't lost weight or changed my diet. My doctor says it could be that my kidneys are getting worse. It's not great news, but I like the idea of getting off my medications. What's going on here?
You know, it's not always totally clear with diabetes. Things can change, like kidneys, how they're working, how they're filtering different medications. And I think we would need a little bit more information from you about what medications you're specifically talking about. But I wonder if you're taking insulin. Sometimes insulin takes a little bit longer to get out of your body if your kidneys aren't working as well. So that may be what your doctor had been talking about.
And I would say it's important for you to bring this back up to your doctor to try to understand why. I mean, the goal is excellent control of your diabetes, yes. And if that means if less medicine is required to keep you in excellent control, that's fantastic. And ultimately, the goal is further weight loss and exercise and making sure you're doing those things too, in addition to the medications, for your overall long-term health. And I would have that conversation of what's going on, and maybe together you and your doctor could brainstorm that, but also really think forward about the things that are important for you to do with your weight and your diet and your exercise, for long-term health.
And for our next question, Erica.
My doctor said that I have elevated blood pressure and was asked if I were taking any supplements. I responded by saying that I took DHEA and multiple other supplements, including Sudafed daily, and also I did smoke a cigarette right before my blood pressure was taken. My doctor turned his head, smiled, and said, "Well, that's the problem. I don't mind stopping the supplements if need be, but they do make me feel better. I'd appreciate your thoughts."
Wow, there's a lot buried into your question. Thank you for writing us and sharing all this stuff with us. There are several points that come to my mind, and I'm sure yours as well, Yi. One is that, yes, it is super important to always tell your doctor what herbal supplements you're taking, or over-the-counter things like Sudafed can definitely raise your blood pressure some. Smoking cigarettes, and you've heard us say it a bunch of times, and surely someone's told you by now the best thing you could do for your health is to quit smoking cigarettes. But that, if smoking one right beforehand, could definitely raise your blood pressure. And then all kinds of questions about is it elevated multiple times, or was just a one-time elevation, and really wanting to have a better picture and further blood pressure checks to know if you do, in fact, have hypertension or high blood pressure.
And specifically, when you asked about DHEA, it's often something that can cause lower blood pressure. So for folks who are taking blood pressure medications already, we sometimes will provide caution about starting something like DHEA. So important, like Christy said, to tell your doctor about all the supplements that you're taking, as well as other over-the-counters, because they really can affect your overall health.
They can. And that's a lot of times they can interact with other medications, as you're alluding, Yi. And there are just multiple reasons why you want to be sure that on your medication list and your chart, and when you talk to your doctor and your healthcare providers, that you have the most accurate and up-to-date information there that includes everything you're taking. Okay, thank you for your questions. A really good one. And we hope that that blood pressure was just a one-time thing, and we hope that you are able to quit smoking as well. All right, Erica, what's your next house call question?
I have a strong family history of alcoholism on my mom's side. At times, I thought I might be drinking too much, but I can also go months without taking a sip of alcohol. I heard there are medications out there to help treat alcohol abuse, and I'm now considering taking medicine. I'd appreciate your thoughts.
Thank you so much for calling in with this question. And it really shows great motivation on your part that you recognize that this is something that runs in your family and may be a problem for you. You know, there are a lot of medications out there. There are some that are under development as well. You know, there's no great, unfortunate magic bullet to help people with this problem. And oftentimes, counseling and groups can be more effective, if not at least as effective, especially with medication.
And I would also encourage you, if you've got this strong family history, and you say sometimes you feel like you're drinking too much, but sometimes you can go months without taking a sip, and you're thinking about medication, I would really think about making sure your overall wellness, that you're tending to that, and that you consider going to AA meetings. Alcoholics Anonymous, even for if you're thinking about medications and you might be drinking more than maybe this question acknowledges, but to the support part of this and the acknowledgement and having a mentor and a partner who can guide you through sobriety is very, very important for moving forward in your life. And so if you are drinking in a way that it's causing problems, or if you're not, but you just want to make sure to prevent that kind of problem with such a strong family history, then doing AA is a really good idea.
And I think definitely bringing this up with your provider and continuing to work on ways that they may be able to help you and guide you and provide more information. If you have a particular medication you've heard about, they can probably talk to you about it, as well as providing more resources like Christy has mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Let's take our very next house call question.
Recently, I noticed bleeding from my bottom after a bowel movement. I had a colonoscopy 3 years ago, and it was normal. My doctor said that it was hemorrhoids and that I shouldn't worry, but I do worry a lot. Should I repeat the colonoscopy?
Lots of questions in there. One, good for you for having your colonoscopy. Everyone over the age of 50 should have one, or sooner if you have a real strong family history or other problems. And it is a very effective way to prevent cancer, because while they're in there, they can take out those little polyps or growths that can become cancer later in life. So it's a very good prevention strategy. If yours was normal 3 years ago, that is a very good sign. And so that is reassuring. But I wonder, and I'd want your doctor to look at that report and see, did they see hemorrhoids when you had the colonoscopy done? A lot of times they can look back and they'll document that you had some hemorrhoids. That would be very reassuring to know that they saw some. I'd also want to know, did they see diverticulosis, or those little pockets in your colon that can sometimes cause bleeding? Or was there anything else that needed follow-up? And then there are all kinds of questions we would have about how much blood are you talking about? If it's just a few drops on the tissue of bright red blood, that's more likely, and especially if it hurt when you were having a bowel movement. or if you're straining. Those are things that kind of go along with hemorrhoids and could be the case. And there are other studies that we can do in the office. Maybe you can explain it. Mm-hmm. That could also help figure it out.
Yes, absolutely. I think this is a great question for your provider and for you to make an appointment and be seen to talk a little bit more about the questions that Christy had. But during that time, an exam can be done. We can actually do some procedures in the clinic that don't require you doing a weekend-long prep. And we should hopefully be able to see some hemorrhoids if you had them, and that might be reassuring. And also maybe do some blood work to see if you've lost so much blood that you're anemic, which is something else that we'd be worried about. But we can definitely provide some more information by checking in with you.
And the last thing is that you say you worry a lot. And I just want to be sure to revisit that, to say, you know, if you are worrying about your body and your health in a way that's hindering you from moving forward or causing problems in your life, that is really something that's worth talking to your doctor about as well, even just a separate appointment to say, you know what, I'm really worried about all these things in my body. It can be scary to have symptoms. And certainly if you're seeing, you know, a little bit of blood on the tissue, that can be scary. But a lot of times those kinds of worries are sort of your body's call or your mind's call to say, hey, you know, I'm suffering a little bit. Maybe that's anxiety. Maybe it's sleep. Maybe it's lack of exercise or stress or other things. But it's important to talk to somebody about that if it is, in fact, something that's going on a lot.
And once again, I think this really revisits the idea of having a good relationship with a provider that you really feel open about being able to talk about these kinds of things with, because it can be difficult, mm-hmm. but important.
Great. Well, we've had fantastic house calls today about diabetes and blood pressure and supplements and alcohol and worries bleeding. And rectal bleeding. Yes, we've talked about all kinds of things, and we appreciate you for sharing that. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns on the show today that are important to you and your health. We want you to share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. Get our health app at the App Store for a free download by searching Your Health one word.
And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship.
And I'd also like to thank Dr. Yi Lam and Dr. Catherine Koh for being such fantastic guest hosts today.
And our guest today, Dr. Marco Iacobani.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Yi Lam.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.